if one's source of pain is politicizing their identity, one needs to fully depoliticize their identity before they can heal.
Welcome to the Whose Body Is It podcast. I'm your host, Isabella Malvin. For those who don't know me, I'm a life coach, a hypnotist, a former birth worker, and a former liberal feminist turned radical truth teller. On this podcast, you'll learn about the ideologies, industries, and technologies attempting to control our minds and bodies, such as transgender ideology, pornography, prostitution, and the many tentacles of the medical industrial complex. Together, we'll untangle patriarchal lies as you listen to jaw-dropping interviews with women from around the world. Warning! While listening to this podcast, you might find yourself triggered or perhaps notice where you've been biting your tongue on the issues that matter most to you. In the masterclasses available on my site, as well as my one-on-one coaching and hypnosis, you will learn to stop getting triggered by every freaking thing, learn to cultivate resilience, gain knowledge, and if we're working together one-on-one, stop unwanted behaviors and increase your self-confidence. You can book your first session and check out the masterclasses in the library at whosebodyisit.com. And I just want to say that it's because of your endless support that I'm able to interview amazing women, get their stories out, and produce regular content for you. So with that being said, please like, comment, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. And if you're just listening in, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and consider making a financial contribution via the link in my show notes. You can also support the podcast by getting your activist stickers. So my pro-woman stickers have the power to intercept transhumanist programming. So take a photo of your stickers out in the wild and tag me on Instagram at Whose Body Is It. Perhaps you're aware of the harms the gender identity industry is causing women and girls and the predatory strategies at play. The disembodiment crisis has gone beyond common issues women and girls have faced in decades past, like anorexia, cutting, illegal drugs, and alcohol. Now we're confronted with institutionally sanctioned self-hate and the denial of biological reality. In addition, women and girls are being programmed to regard their instinctual disgust towards men who masquerade as women as paranoia and bigotry. While awareness is slowly being raised, many are still embedded in the medical industrial complex, DSM diagnoses, prescription medications, and outdated therapeutic models. Culturally, we're beginning to see the consequences of what isn't working, so where do we go from here? What can we do to fortify ourselves and our daughters in a socio-political climate that enforces the ludicrous idea that sex is a spectrum and our bodies are simply Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head parts that can be mixed, matched, and discarded? How do we teach our girls to occupy their bodies instead of abandoning them? And what are the practical, actionable things we can do in our day-to-day lives to model embodiment? With her robust background in depth psychology and nearly a decade of activism advocating for the safety and well-being of women and girls, in the upcoming class, Amy Souza will provide the foundation to recover your instincts and build resilience in the age of gender disinformation and disembodiment. You can either join us live on Saturday, April 13th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or buy access to the class and watch the replay. You'll find the link to join in the episode show notes. Without further ado, let's get into this week's story. Lee, you're back. You're back on the podcast. It's been almost a year since we recorded, and I haven't told you this yet, but up until like a week ago, Amy Souza's episode was number one on podcast platforms, and your episode from 11 months ago is now number one played on podcast platforms.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, whoa. Yeah. We got a lot of meat to get into.
Yes.
On the update.
Yeah. So if this is your first time hearing Lee speak, hearing me interview Lee, then I would just like pause this and just go back, listen to the first episode from 11 months ago, and then listen to this one. I guess it could be kind of cool if you listen to this all the way through and then listen to the first one too. Either way, it's going to be a full of wisdom, truth bombs. That was such a powerful interview from 11 months ago. And I'm just so glad to have you back. And so give us like a kind of a brief life update. What have you been doing for 11 months?
Yes. Well, for the past almost year since I recorded with you, which was outstanding and a game changer for me because of how much external confrontation, both really positive and full of scorn as well, I was able to interface. The past year has been messy and beautiful and full of redemptive arcs through very deep moments of doubt and pain, and a lot of getting to know myself again, accepting myself after publicly eviscerating my soul for the hopes that some people who need it could learn from my mistakes. I switched jobs, went back to my old job. I've been talking to pretty much everybody I meet about my story and seeing where it lands. And for those who aren't familiar with my story, identified as non-binary, trans, even before the labels were created, from age 6 to age 30. Experienced an awakening at 30 after my sterilization at 29 that inspired me to identify as D-trans. And crucially, since we recorded, the biggest breakthrough that I've made is detransitioning from detransition. And so I want this interview hopefully to be more conversational, but also to really focus on how, if one's source of pain is politicizing their identity, one needs to fully depoliticize their identity before they can heal. And for me, I'm so grateful for coming out as D-trans, for everything I've learned. But if I had stopped there and stayed there, I'd be just as disembodied as I was being trans. And I think it's because of what politicizing your identity forces you to be in your intellect about it, rather than in your body about it. And whenever you are unbalanced and ruled by your mind, you're susceptible to extremism. I was susceptible to extremism. I got very proud and very angry after our interview, both as a result of the praise and the warmth inflating my sense of self, but then also feeling equally and viciously attacked by peers and strangers, a mass exodus of peers from my life, from speaking publicly, and sometimes even going too far about extrapolating my pain about the gender confusion to broader issues about queerness or sexuality or even identity at all in America. So I'm so stoked to dive in. As a consequence of my enabling my own misunderstanding, which I was confronted with by how many people only listen to the soundbite, and they really only listen to the soundbite about soft suicide, about transition being a soft suicide, because that's what it was for me. That focus on that soundbite enabled many people who were already convinced that the only problem is criticism of trans ideology or gender ideology or transhumanism and modernity more broadly. That misunderstanding and association with literal violence pushed me to really evaluate my entire life and my timeline through my pain. And I decided to write it down because, if anything, people can look through my entire story and my deeply revised and over-revised and very thoughtful written word about my life. I made this into a website, detransitionandgrow.org. It's my testimony of personal growth. It is not a preamble for any lawsuit for anyone who's done me wrong. It's a exposé of what it's like to be a self and for that self to grow from pain into embodiment. So many updates that we can focus on. And I'm so stoked to have this opportunity to speak with you again, because it's what you have here is very moving and very inspiring, and a safe space for women and a safe space too for people who aren't women to witness women being safety to each other. So I deeply yearn for an expansion of that true and loving way of being to everyone in our culture, no matter where they're at. So thank you for having me back.
Oh, thank you for that reflection. I love what you said. I think I'm gonna have to write it down and put it on my website, the allowing both men and women to witness women being safe for one another. That's, wow, I never thought about it like that.
It's the best kind of revolutionary.
Oh.
The kind that breathes life and not fear, you know?
Wow. I want to backtrack a little bit. You mentioned the scorn and the praise. Would you mind sharing maybe like one of each? Like, what was maybe the most touching or rewarding praise that you got from a woman or a man? And then on the other side, you know, yeah, what was kind of the harshest scorn that you faced after the interview was published?
I think above all things, I cherish being connected with fellow detransitioners. Also, crucially, adult detransitioners. People who do not fall into the rightfully and tragically necessarily political category of children who have gone through life-changing permanent surgeries and chemical intervention. That issue is very serious and needs to be seriously addressed. And there are many deeply serious people embarking on that. But for us adults who are legally responsible for the life-altering decisions that we made, there's really nothing more cathartic or that rings true like a support group than people who made your same mistakes. And so being connected with a few women who were formerly trans identified, have no one to blame but themselves, just like me, and who were able just the overlap in the errors we made about ourselves, about hating ourselves as women, the role of learning the role of pornography and sexual violence, and even homosexuality, and being confused about how others perceive you. Solidarity in that was life-affirming for me. And it was life-affirming in a radically community-oriented way for me, because so much of my own pain was the result of estrangement from people that I held dearest to my heart. So it's kind of been like the silver lining is a revival of sisterhood for me. I have a deep sister wound that cries out to be healed, and the people that called to that cry have been the most loving and funny and thoughtful women ever. So, I mean, that alone, I would do our interview over and over and over and over again, right? Because that, like I said, life affirming. And then the most extreme scorn that I received from is also personal. People that I knew personally coming out against me, using the soundbite and saying that I was doing harm to niche communities, that my speaking about my experience, that I was weaponizing my experience against people who are suffering more than myself. I was condemned for fueling the fire of right-wing extremism, very so demonized that I would say about 90% of my peer group flew from my life. So, people I went to school with, the people that I knew in real life that reacted against me were university peers.
So this is so interesting to me. I mean, this is horrible, and I'm so sorry you went through this, and I can't imagine how. Oh, I can't imagine, because I've been through it myself for different reasons. However, I didn't, yeah, so I'm surprised. Would you say this was like a second mass unfriending, or like had you already been through a big kind of purge of people, or was this it for you? Because I guess I wrongly assumed that leaving the gender cult, you would have already lost a lot of these people.
So crucially, I think people were terrified with how low-key viral our interview went. So they didn't see me as a threat when I was just some weirdo online shaving my head or not. You know, these peers were the peers that congratulated me for getting sterilized, because that I was doing a service to humanity by not reproducing. So they had no ideological issues with my extremism in my life. To them, it was like punk and made me like a literal token. So when I was a they, them, they, she, trans identified laborer and nonprofit environmental land, and then I veiled my detransition in the beginning. It began subtly as I'm going to grow my hair out, I'm going to lean into my antisociality by, oh, I'm dyeing my hair black now. I'm gonna be goth and hurt for the soul of the world, right? Like I was covert until our interview.
I see.
And crucially, the reason why it took me so long to reach out to you is because a really important person that I had to lose in my life in order to speak publicly about this was my best friend since kindergarten. A sister, a soul sister of mine, a 25-year friendship I ended over being triggered about gender and my relationship there. My friend's ongoing relationship with my sister, who I'm estranged from. So after I destroyed that friendship with what I thought was righteous anger, I was really reminded so much more of loss and mourning, and that trigger of heartbreak in me is what inspired me to speak. And my way of speaking is, regardless of how much truth I'm able to communicate, the force of my intellect comes across as aggressive to many people. So for them, my being able to articulate my pain in such stark terms, and to be able to connect my pain, my personal pain, to broader cultural issues was dangerous. And as a result of my being a danger, I got canceled. And I got canceled through ostracization. And so now, like I said, 90% of my peer group from my university years gone. They will have nothing to do with me. I've tried refriending people. I've tried reaching out. I've even tried apologizing to some people. Nothing. Stonewall. I'm dead to them. But for the first time in my life, I'm alive. So, you give and you get, and some things are taken, and then a gift takes their place. So.
And it makes so much sense given what you shared with us, in the first interview about just the location of your university, like, being a coastal, having grown up in a coastal elite city. I share that with you. Having grown up in New York City, I went to RISD. My mom still gets the RISD catalog. What are the alumni up to? Like, what's RISD up to today, this semester? And I'm just like, garbage, like throw it in the garbage. Like, it really pains me to look through it because I see my peers who I no longer have contact with, except for one. And all the art that is featured is identity politics stuff. Like, it's just a, yeah, I mean, it just, yeah, they're totally captured. And it's painful to look at. And, university is a place where most people make their like lifelong friends. Like, that's where you make your adult friends. That's where people meet their partners. That's where you, networking connections to further your career. It's a really, really significant time, those 4 formative years. And yeah, I just really feel for you on that. And I'm sure you know this, but there are silent supporters. Like, there are the people who are just gonna trickle out slowly. It's what happened to me. Like, so that's just like a little bit of friend medicine on top of all of the big open wounds that come from, yeah, being ostracized. I mean, it's just that core, those core wounds, like being bullied, being left out, knowing other people are telling, your peers not to talk to you. It's a really, it's not the nicest feeling in the world.
Right. But so what has been so gratifying for me is that The opposite has been true joining the workforce. I got my master's degree as well in a coastal, less elite city, Humboldt County, so rural Northern California, a very much more even split of social liberalism and social conservatism. And, I would put myself right in the center. I'm not a conservative by any means, and I'm no longer radical, but I am honest. And I have been finding that the most sincere and lovely relationships with coworkers, with construction workers that I monitor their work as a biologist to ensure that their work doesn't impact environmental resources negatively. And there's so much solidarity that I've built just being myself. And for as many people as I lost from my intellectual university ivory tower crowd, I've gained them back tenfold, working in real life. Also, my self-esteem as an employed person compared to a student is like has been a huge game changer. Being able to, by my merit, earn a living wage is a huge game changer. And the generosity that the workers of America have, being able to work together in a team to accomplish really large scale goals, that has transformed me profoundly over the past year and given me so much optimism about how much we have in common. And nobody has canceled me. Crucially, like one of the reasons why I left one of my companies was out of fear for being fired for our interview. And I actually ended up coming back to that company because the truth of the matter is, they're like, you're a person. You can discuss your true experience of reality however you want on your own time, so long as you're not like, they're not company policies. That's your life. You're valuable as a worker. You do your job right. Like, so long as you're not using the job as a soapbox stand, you're good. You're fine just being yourself. And I didn't believe that. I didn't believe that because I was like, oh, this, there are some my company ascribes to ESG, as environmental, social, governance. They're this close away from the social credit score. Like, oh, there's no way they're not going to fire me for thought crime. Absolutely not. Like, that was my extremism. When in reality, you can be your full self and work in America in a dignified fashion. And I found that the right-wing construction company that I left my globalist ESG job for, which I thought I would find safety in due to the right-wing aspect of it. Well, guess what? Then I was confronted by major sexism. Also, guess what? The person that I managed, he had two trans-identified sisters. So, like, the issue of gender and how it is weaponized in America affects everybody. It's inescapable. And so the best thing you can do is be in a workplace in which you're safe to be yourself.
Just the irony of this conversation and what we hear, like the safe space, you know, is this a safe space? You know, the emphasis on safe space being a total inversion when it actually becomes a not safe space for anyone who doesn't believe in the rhetoric of gender ideology and safe space. It doesn't add up. Oh my gosh. So you were managing a man who had two trans identified sisters. That's wild. So you went back to your old job.
Right. And crucially, with this young man I was managing, I shared with him my story. And I spoke with him about how important it is to continue to love his trans family members. And at the time, I also spoke candidly about, like, hey, I get that you call them your brothers, and I'm going to call them your siblings because I personally can't go that far. But I recognize that you love your family, and I love you for loving your family. Like, no, nothing wrong comes from that. And sometimes when people are really hurt, they can only handle the truth that they're loved.
What did he say to that?
I mean, he was, I think he was really, really happy that someone made it out. Me. And to know that someone can, from age 6 to age 30, be entirely confused about themselves and then come out of it. No matter how much time you spend trying to not be yourself, at any time you can be yourself. And that was very moving. It was a very loving and true and sincere conversation.
Wow, that's beautiful.
And
That's
I've
beautiful.
had those conversations with many, many, many people. Just in the process of explaining myself to them.
Yeah.
And by no person in my workplace, in any workplace, have I been rejected for being myself or threatened with, being fired for speaking about who I am.
That's awesome. That's so wonderful to hear. You mentioned a few times moving away from extremism and how, you know, leaving that job initially was part of your detrans, you know, extreme identity. Can you talk a little bit more about moving away from the detrans identity? Because we see the way that it's been popularized. Like we see the Tucker Carlson, we see the Daily Wire going with this. Like, I mean, a lot of my, I actually struggled with titling a lot of the interviews that I've done. I started off saying detrans women, and then I moved into saying formally identified as trans woman, formally identifying as trans. Like, I even noticed the way that I was like using the term so frequently. Permanently and frequently, yes. And yeah, and I've had so many conversations with, you know, I would say Mary Lou Singleton in particular about this trap, you know, and I understand that especially young women's stories, especially women who were medicalized as children, it's really important to emphasize, you know, these parts of the story in order to raise awareness and like what is the line, you know, where it gets exploitative, like knowing that these women are actually still, some of them are still minors,
Right.
the men too, the young men as well. So yeah, maybe if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit more about maybe some aha moments of moving away from the detrans identity.
Yes. Oh. So I really pushed myself to be eviscerating honest about the how. If your problem is politicizing your identity in the first place, which was true for me when I was identifying as non-binary and trans, you're not out of the clear until you have fully depoliticized your identity. And so detrans is as extreme and was for me as extreme as trans identification. They're both shame-based identities. So my detrans identity was plagued by the guilt that I had formerly been proselytizing for gender ideology. So as an act of atonement, I felt compelled to distance myself aggressively from my past self. And as someone whose gender issues dovetailed with eating disorder, as is common with people who turn to gender as the result of social contagion rather than any other thing going on, it reminded me of how much I hated my fat self when I was anorexic. So when I was detrans, I hated my trans self so much that I still had not escaped the cycle of belief, that deep-seated belief that I deserved to be punished. And if no one was going to punish me, I was responsible for punishing myself. And so there was still this, I had not escaped the greater sadomasochism that reducing oneself to an identity demands. And in the process of writing my story, I was radically confronted by my own misunderstanding of my own timeline, which grief tends to confuse. When we did our interview, I was fresh out of the grief of being sterilized. It was so confusing and painful for me that I could bring that upon myself, that I needed to purge my heart of all of those beliefs that led me to that rock bottom. And when I went back through my written record, the actual timeline, what was true is that I actually went through with the surgery after I had already peaked and after I detransitioned. So the surgery that was the fruition of my transition was acted upon while I was beginning to identify as detrans. And by looking at what actually happened to me and when I made crucial decisions, I recall the fact that when I was deeply ashamed of my gender ideology manifesting as confused and sometimes even bordering on the schizophrenic expressions after experiencing sexual violence and shame therein, I deleted my Facebook that I started as a kid. And all of those images, that online persona, like so much of that wasn't backed up. So when I made the decision to delete that account for the first time, I lost years of my life, years of photographic record of my life. So even as I was struggling to populate my written story, detransition and grow with images, I was like, wow, I wish I could find this one picture because it's so perfect. Like when I had a buzz cut shaved head and was wearing all Carhartts and was like totally like I was Phoenix Darkwater. I was a man. I needed to appear as a man to believe I was safe from sexual assault. Like I went through that period. And then I deleted that archive and now it's gone. Poof. So what happened to me on the cusp of becoming trans to detrans I was sterilized in June of 2022. When going back through my archives, the only record I have of my surgery is my email confirmation. And I deleted every single photo, every single screenshot, every writing. Like it's a blackout period for me. And so it took friends of mine that I made as a fresh detrans person, where we started a book club in which we read Right Wing Women by Andrea Dworkin, and we read Transsexual Empire by Janice Raymond. That happened around April 2022. I start to detransition in April.
When you say detransition, do you mean, were you on testosterone at that point?
No. So I never.
You never took testosterone, right?
Right.
That, okay, that I remember. Okay, so when you say detrans, you mean psychological detrans. Okay.
A psychological detransition. And I would call it desistance if not for how within the past 5 years or even as far as 10 years, non-binary and trans were conflated. So that combination where all of a sudden non-binary and trans became the same thing, that meant that I could go from the more poetic, abstract, like weird pretendy thing of non-binary and concretize it with trans. So that too was a transition within my psyche. The, oh, I'm non-binary, and wait, now I'm non-binary trans. So I wanted to sterilize myself when I transitioned from non-binary to trans. But what was true is that as I went from trans to detrans, I went through with the surgery when I was technically identifying as detrans. And so when I found out that that's really how the timeline worked out for me, one, it proved to me multiple things. One, that when I was detrans, I was still trans. I still believed that the only way to solve my internal psychological problems was a surgical intervention. And two, that the process of becoming detrans is the same and opposite reaction as as identifying as trans for me, because I believed that I was still primarily motivated by terror. And the terror of trans was I'm going to get raped if I'm perceived as a woman. And the terror of detrans was there's no way to escape the terror of being perceived as a woman and raped. So I'm going to surgically ensure that I never carry a rapist baby, that I also never subject my own children to a world in which, if they're perceived as vulnerable, they're going to be raped or sexually assaulted. So that's where the extreme of fearing sexual violence was. Was the root of my trans identity and was equally the root of my detrans identity. And I needed to detransition from detransition to feel safe in my body as a woman, even though nothing about the culture has changed. And I still worry about sexual assault and rape. I still worry about that for future generations. It's a terrible problem. Like the fastest growing population of rapists is K through 12. because of exposure to violent pornography when your nervous system has no capacity to understand such things. But what has changed within me is a devotion to embodiment. And even embodied as a woman who is vulnerable to sexual harassment, sexual assault, and rape, the ease of being in my body and also creating a community of women who have also survived such things and have had to piece themselves together Humpty Dumpty style afterwards, that joint project of continuing to be yourself no matter what the world throws at you, and especially in terms of sexualized terrorism, that is what made me whole. Not gender ideology or any orientation to gender, being embodied and feeling safe in my body for the first time in 30 years.
As you're sharing, I'm thinking back to what I thought your timeline was when you shared. And I remember you making the distinction and saying, I was sterilized not because of the gender identity stuff, but I also was unclear about the timeline
Right,
and
was.
what you're saying. Yeah, and you were too. Yeah, until you in the process of you writing your testimony, put the pieces together. Yeah. And I had no idea how recently you had been sterilized, like given the timing of our conversation. That's also news to me. But I do now recall you were never on testosterone. And so this makes your story like, I mean, your story I think is unique for a lot of reasons. But yeah, I appreciate you using the detrans and not the desist because of the reasons you just outlined. Yeah, and I'm also just thinking to what you just shared as well about the project of piecing yourself back together, like the women in your group that you're talking about that have been pieced up, kind of tried to be taken apart Humpty Dumpty style. That project is a worthy project indeed, and that yeah, that the antidote. I'm also hearing you say like the antidote to what you've been through is not more ideology, more identity. It's actually, yeah, occupying your
Yeah.
body and community and connection, and acceptance too, like true acceptance. Like in the case of your job, like you can be who you are here.
Yeah.
You can be who you are. You do not have to hide who you are. And yeah, the gift of being able to be comfortable in your body. Wow. It's saves
Right.
a
So
lot of time.
yes, so much. And this is where ideology and its relationship with the intellect really captures people. And as you say, captures entire institutions and cultures. It's mistaking ideology for knowledge. And then using that knowledge to create a false sense of well-being when a true sense of well-being is always doesn't know and simply is, right? So I think about last interview, we discussed how part of my journey with myself involved pretty significant intersections into exploring religion. And for me personally, being pursued by multiple Christians in an attempt to convert me to heal my heartbreak. I bring that up because one quote that has struck me so deeply to my core that I like. Praise God is from Paul in the New Testament. And the quote says, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And so every time I identified as something, I thought I knew myself. I really thought I knew. And when I thought I knew, I was proud and I was arrogant. And underneath that pride was such a looming and deep, dark emptiness that plagued me with doubt and depression and shame. It took learning to love a little better to have any breathing room from nihilism. And to love well is to not know. Mystery is the lifeblood of love. And when you decide that someone is something, and when you decide yourself is something, you kill it. And that's why I called it a soft suicide, because I decided what I was. And when I decided, I was killing everything off in me that was alive, that was mysterious, that was whole and desperate to get out and breathe and to enjoy the sunshine, right? Enjoy the warmth and the glow of aliveness. And so if I've learned one thing in this weird life and from my own intellect, it's the more I know, the more violence I do to myself and others. And so as someone as intellectual as myself, whose baseline is conflating myself with my thoughts, it's a total game changer to be and to breathe and to meditate. And one of the most fun things that I've realized since understanding how dangerous my intellect can be, what do I do to entertain my intellect now? Instead of going online and pretending to be something for other people's approval, I learn. I listen to books on tape. I spend all my like waking free hours that I can handle learning about history and learning about philosophy and touching back on concepts in science, the relativity revolution, quantum science, botany, like whatever. I understand now that part of my being is this mind that needs to constantly work itself out, like chess players burning the same amount of calories as Olympic athletes, right? Like this activity, if you struggle with mistaking yourself for your intellect, the best thing you can do is treat your intellect like the animal it is and take care of it. That's simple. And write. Writing helps. If you are a highly verbal person, sometimes you can only understand yourself better when you put yourself out on the page and get to witness your own mind working out its evolution. And so that's why I wrote. Plenty of my fellow detransitioners have also coped with writing. And I get feedback every day from my new friends that they love the development out of detransition. They love being themselves. And they too have had to let go of politicizing their identity to be happy, to be here, to really enjoy their bodies for the first times in their lives.
Makes a lot of sense when you lay it out like that, Lee. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Anyone can do it.
And it's not about getting rid of that part of yourself that is the intellectual and is such a critical thinker and loves to solve. It's just about reharnessing it and not letting it be influenced by undue
Fear.
forces and fear.
Like the that really underpinning all of my suffering was my inability to integrate my fear and my rage. And since I have embarked on this journey, one of the major symptoms of my lack of self-acceptance were panic attacks. And a major change through this past year, since we've had our first interview, is I have not had a panic attack in a year. The panic attack started for me around that, you know, age six. So from age 6 to 30, I was regularly having panic attacks in which they were so extreme that, and talk about fear of my intellect. Every time I would have one of these panic attacks, I would violently beat my head just to try to make it stop.
Oh my gosh, that's absolutely frightening.
So frightening. I mean, talk about, like, we understand why mental illness is mistaken for demon possession, right? Like, it's extreme. The self-violence because you, out of lack of self-acceptance, is extreme and terrifying. I have been extreme and terrifying to my loved ones due to my self-hatred from age 6 to age 30. And I'm 31 now and 1 year panic attack free, 1 year free of beating my own head almost to the, thank God I've never gotten a concussion from it, you know?
I was just going to say, it's not a good part of the body to bang on the wall.
No. No, and I've hurt my hand, my own fist against my skull, you know, like, and a perfect example, you know, Ellen Page, in her autobiography, she talks about violent bouts of physical self-harm during panic attacks. And I'm like, yeah, no wonder why you think that replacing your external self will help you escape from that relationship with yourself in which you genuinely crave your destruction. Every panic attack I had, I wanted to die. I wanted to rip my chest open so my soul could escape this whole world. And a year of that not happening has been nothing short of a miracle for me. And if I can do it, anyone can.
Wow, that is so remarkable. Wow, I had no idea. Yeah, speaking to you last time, I had no idea how extreme yourself. I mean, you were talking about eating disorders and being sterilized. So yeah, okay. But yeah, hearing you speak in detail about that process of self-harm and now being 1 year free, that's huge miracle, remarkable. And yeah, an inspiration to any woman who is dealing with adjacent issues or the exact same issue as what you've just described. I mean,
absolutely.
Wow. Thank you for, yeah, being so vulnerable and sharing that part of your story. I think it's a really important part. You know, I think it's easy to make up stories that, like, I'm the worst, you know, like other women have stuff going on, but like, I can't recover. You know, my story is worse than all the others. My story is more extreme. I hate myself more. I you know, like there's no hope for me.
Yeah.
So I appreciate, as explicit as that was, I appreciate you. Yeah. Sharing that so that women listening who are dealing with similar or the same issues can be inspired by your evolution. And again, talking to you last year, there was so much evolution and so much clarity, and to know that you're in like this next, I mean, it's just, it's really remarkable. And what? And so, sorry, say it again.
all uphill from here.
All uphill from here. Absolutely.
Like you climb the
Totally.
mountain and the view from it's from the ridge lines are breathtaking and awe-inspiring and make you keep going. For as depressed as I was during our first interview, that still was like what is it? The first step of a long journey is the hardest. But once you embark upon being yourself and being honest, it's a process that refines you, not the other way around. And so I really am so grateful that we did our first interview because I wouldn't be here if not for that. I wouldn't be here if not for the praise and the scorn and the pride and the humility. It's all a part of it. And when you are able to finally look at yourself from a bird's eye view and behold how magnificent personal growth really is, then there's nothing to fear anymore. There's nothing to rage against the machine about. There's just a clearing for allowing other people to do the same around you because you've done that for yourself. And that social contagion, like if social contagion can be used for our detriment, it can also be used for our benefit. And at this point, that is my little mission on planet Earth. Whoever needs to hear how my journey through shame and embarrassment and self-rejection and battling against my being, if that helps even one person, then I've mission accomplished, right? And so I said that to my friend Ray, who you've also interviewed, and I was talking about my like, man, if I would have helped one person, this all would have been worth it. And she's like, Lee, you helped me. I'm one person. Like I'm myself now because you helped. And I'm like, oh, like that can really just go on and on and on and on. And it does every day. And every time it's a miracle, and I think our nation would do a lot better focusing on everyday miracles instead of ruining the chaotic conditions that make people so confused enough to need miracles in the first place, right? Like it really matters what we choose to focus on, and going back to love building up. Love invites people to be themselves. And so we can all do that for each other. And you've done that for me. And you've helped me do that for others. And those others are helping others go on for others. You know what I mean? Like,
It is contagious.
it's contagious.
I love it. This is the love, the social contagion.
Like wildflower blooms are,
Oh, yes.
you know what I mean? Life will continue to go on and flourish no matter what how we criticize it. Like the criticism is a useful tool to a certain extent, but you have to be able to get a break from that in order to really bask in the resplendence of personal growth.
Well, I think that is a beautiful note. All the notes are beautiful to end on, but I think that's a beautiful way to end. And I want to just plug your testimony, which is on detransitionandgrow.org. It's beautifully laid out. You've got art that you made, your self-portraits that you made when you were non-identifying as non-binary. I mean, it's really fascinating the way that you've laid it out. It's beautifully laid out. I would encourage everyone who want to dive in more into your story to read your full testimony, to share your testimony with others. Enjoy the sequence of how she's laid it out. Is there anything more that you'd like to speak to that we didn't get to so far?
One thing that I added to my website was a contact form in which anyone can send me a message. I hope that people feel inspired to reach out to me in long form, whether they have stories to share, or even if they have a criticism for any ways in which they think that I've taken my personal growth and projected it unfairly onto other people. Whatever, like I hope that my writing my thoughts down encourages others who are struggling with aspect of what's going on culturally or within themselves regarding gender. I hope it inspires discourse, thoughtful discourse. That's what I'm here for. If my witnessing anyone speaking about themselves is what they need to continue to move forward, like, all the better. It's a safe space, but like genuinely.
Thank you so much, Lee. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or family member who needs to hear this content. And if you do share it on social media, don't forget to follow and tag me at Whose Body Is It? So until next time.